VOA News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. Eyewitnesses and sources on the ground tell VOA that Islamic State fighters are resorting to producing acrid smoke and leveling suicide attacks to hamper the advances of the U.S.-backed forces on their last stronghold in eastern Syria. Local sources have said that in an attempt to make one final stand in the Syrian town of Baghouz, IS fighters are now burning tires to produce smoke to prevent U.S.-led airstrikes and have intensified suicide attacks against U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. The IS tactics have slightly slowed progress of the U.S.-backed forces into Baghouz, according to SDF officials. Members of the House and Senate on Tuesday were said to be optimistic about a deal that has been negotiated in a congressional conference committee to provide money for border security and keep the government open. President Trump was not happy about the agreement.
I can't say I'm happy. I can't say I'm thrilled. But the wall's getting built. Regardless, doesn't matter, because we're doing other things beyond what we're talking about here.
The deal grants far less than the $5.7 billion the president was seeking to begin building a wall along the southern U.S. border. At least 17 people died on Tuesday as a fire tore through a budget hotel in New Delhi before dawn. The Hotel Arpit Palace is in a congested part of central New Delhi. Hundreds of demonstrators gathered in some Sudanese cities on Tuesday, protesting against autocratic President Omar al-Bashir. The current wave of protests began December 19th, initially over surging prices and a failing economy, but have shifted now to calls for an end to Bashir's three-decade rule. This is VOA News. North Korea's nuclear and other military capabilities remain unchanged and still pose a threat to the United States and its allies. That, the testimony of General Robert Abrams, head of U.S. Forces Korea, on Tuesday before the Senate Armed Services Committee. He said little to no verifiable change has taken place in North Korea's military capabilities, despite the North's public statements about denuclearization. The Afghan Taliban is preparing to enter new talks with the United States, Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The Taliban have announced a 14-member negotiating team ahead of talks this month with U.S. envoy Zalmay Khalilzad, who has been meeting with the insurgents to try to end America's longest war. The group includes five former members of the U.S. prison in Guantanamo Bay, who were released in 2014 in exchange for a captured American soldier, and the jailed younger brother of the leader of the Haqqani Network, a powerful Taliban faction. The Taliban are refusing to meet directly with the U.S.-backed government in Kabul.
The Afghan government on Tuesday fired its election commission more than 3 months after chaotic parliamentary elections, the results of which have still not been announced. Last October's parliamentary vote was held 3 years late. They were marred by widespread chaos. The Mexican drug kingpin, nicknamed El Chapo, has been convicted in a federal court in New York. Associated Press correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
The jury returned a verdict against the notorious drug lord Joaquin Guzman on its sixth day of deliberation. The drug trafficking charges could put the 61-year-old defendant in prison for life. He was accused of smuggling 200 tons of cocaine and of using torture and murder to cement his control of the Sinaloa drug cartel. He was famous for escaping from prisons in Mexico, and the trial was held under extraordinary security before an anonymous jury.
The Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido says humanitarian aid would be brought into the country on February 23rd, even though President Nicolas Maduro has refused to let it in. Guaido is recognized by the United States and about 50 other countries as the interim president of Venezuela. On Tuesday, he spoke to thousands of supporters who demonstrated as part of an ongoing campaign to break the military support for Maduro and force the socialist leader from power. Guaido has been pressing for emergency food and medicine from the U.S. to be transported into the economically devastated country. Those supplies have been at a warehouse in the Colombian border town of Cúcuta. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world, around the clock, at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz. VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon military and the separatists accuse each other for attack on a hospital.
I just pray that my colleagues who are out, that they ran away from the incident, they should come back since government said they are assuring them of their security.
Rosemary Kimby is a nurse at Kumba District Hospital in southwest Cameroon. Nigerians go to the polls in 3 days' time to elect their next president. We'll have profiles of the two leading candidates. Guinea-Bissau teachers plan to strike again tomorrow, Thursday. And who carried out a second armed attack on a radio station critical of Liberian President George Weah?
While I cannot say definitively it was sanctioned by the government, I cannot at all rule out that radical elements within the government or within the CDC might have been the one who carried it out.
That's Liberian political commentator Henry Costa, owner of Roots FM. We'll also hear from Liberia's information minister. And Burundian women talk about their role in peace building during the country's ethnic violence. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burned down a hospital in the Cameroonian town of Kumba this week, forcing patients and medical staff to flee for their lives. Cameroon's government blames the attack on separatists who are demanding independence for the country's English-speaking regions. The nation's National Order of Doctors has condemned the attack as barbaric. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Kumba.
It was quiet Tuesday at the Kumba District Hospital in the southwest region of Cameroon. On a normal day, the hospital cares for hundreds of patients and pregnant women. But none were here today, one day after the attack that reduced most of the buildings to ashes. Nurse Rosemary Kimby says the hospital complied with government orders to discharge 90% of the patients.
The patients that were a little bit better, we send them home. Women who delivered, we send them back home. We took the instruction that the government gave that we should see that serious cases should be dispatched to different hospitals around. I just pray that my colleagues who are out, that they ran away from the incident, they should come back since government said they are assuring them of their security.
About 80% of the staff did not report for work Tuesday. 14-year-old Marvelous Manka, whose mother is being treated for cancer, says her mother may die because their doctor is absent and there is no one to attend to them. She says they have been asked to go to another specialist hospital in the neighboring town of Boya.
All the roads are blocked and there's no one moving in town. I just pray to God that the situation to change and everything to come back. God should just help for this strike to stop.
The government of Cameroon says at least 20 armed separatists attacked and set fire to the hospital in the early hours of Monday. It says 4 people, including 2 patients, were killed. Local newspapers report that the separatists may have been angry that the hospital was treating government troops wounded in the separatist war and disclosing the identities of armed fighters to the military. Titani Ekwe, president of the Cameroon Medical Council, denies the accusations.
Ça nous laisse véritablement sans voix. L'Ordre national des médecins du Cameroun.
He says the National Order of Cameroon doctors and all medical staff in Cameroon are speechless because they have always respected neutrality in the conflict between the Cameroon military and armed groups. He says when a priceless service to humanity like healthcare delivery and a hospital are attacked and torched for whatever reason, the medical staff can only be shocked and expect justice to take its course. On social media, the separatists insisted that the hospital was torched by Cameroon's military to discredit them and tarnish their image. Renewed fighting erupted in Cameroon's 2 English-speaking regions this month after armed separatists began what they call a 10-day lockdown, banning many activities in the war-torn Anglophone regions through February 14. Cameroon's unrest began in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers demonstrated against the growing dominance of French in the officially bilingual country. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kumba, Southwestern Cameroon.
Nigeria's top two candidates for Saturday's presidential election are not new to politics, nor, for that matter, running for president in Africa's most populous nation for the first time. But the race between President Muhammadu Buhari and challenger Atiku Abubakar is not just close in terms of who could win, but also on the main campaign issues. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Two political heavyweights, both former leaders in their 70s, are vying for the top office in Nigeria. 76-year-old incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari swept to power in 2015 on promises to improve Nigeria's security, oil-dependent economy, and reputation for rampant corruption. His opponent, 72-year-old former vice president and businessman Atiku Abubakar, is campaigning on a similar platform. Analyst Julian Parker has been studying Nigeria for a decade and says this year's poll, with its striking similarities to previous polls, might provoke apathy among voters.
These two frontrunners in the election race have been in politics for decades. This is not their first time either for running for president. Between them, they've nearly run for the presidency 10 times.
Both men have stressed the need for greater security, particularly in the fight against Islamist militants in the north, and for economic diversity, away from Nigeria's dependence on oil. While their words on the other crucial issue, corruption, are similar, their reputations differ. Buhari made clean governance his signature issue and is widely described in Nigeria as incorruptible. But in an interview with VOA, he agreed with critics that corruption has not been wiped out.
Yes, there will always be people who will be prepared to offer bribes. But what we feel is just like the military operation. Whoever is caught accepting bribe, you know, will certainly be dealt with.
But Abubakar, known as Atiku to his followers, is dogged by corruption allegations, which he quickly denied in an interview with VOA. He said he plans to take a hardline approach on corruption as well.
You just have to strengthen your laws and also strengthen your processes to make sure that people don't escape, and also make sure that people who are accused of corruption are tried in a very, very fast manner. I certainly will not agree or allow a situation where corrupt trials last for several years.
While some analysts predict a tight presidential race, it could come down to demographics and identity politics. But Parker says voters should also look at Buhari's health problems. He spent several months of his first term living abroad and receiving treatment for an unspecified illness.
Buhari's health is a huge factor. It's a huge source of concern for a lot of people, you know, investing in Nigeria in terms of, you know, is he going to be able to complete his term? What does that mean for the political stability?
She notes that Buhari is backed by a popular deputy, Oluyemi Osinbajo.
We know that Buhari will, if he has to, will hand over to his deputy. And his deputy is actually a very dynamic, business-friendly, young guy who's got quite a lot of national appeal. He's been able to broker peace in the rest of Niger Delta region.
In December, Buhari denied rumors he had died and been replaced by a body double. As for his health, he said, he is going strong. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Today's Wednesday, February 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. A Liberian political commentator and critic of President George Weah and his government says he suspects radical elements within the government or the ruling Congress for Democratic Change to have carried out an armed attack on his radio station. Henry Costa, owner of Roots FM, says the station's technicians were doing routine maintenance work on the transmitters when they were attacked on the 9th of February 10th. And the station's transmitters and other equipment taken. This was the second armed attack on Roots FM in less than 2 weeks. Costa says while he has no definitive facts to point the finger at the government, he blames the government for inciting such attacks.
I woke up sometime around 7 a.m., went to my cell phone, and I saw, you know, an influx of messages and calls from Liberia. So I immediately called my operations manager. And he broke the very disturbing news to me that at 3 a.m., according to the watchmen who guard our facility where our broadcast equipment are kept, three men made a way, scaled the wall, the fence, jumped into the yard, put him on a gunpoint, as was done 2 weeks ago. And this time they came prepared with tools. And they chiseled the wall, destroyed the locks they do, made their way into the building, and took all of our broadcast equipment. While I cannot say definitively it was sanctioned by the government, but I cannot at all rule out that radical elements within the government or within the CDC might have been the one who carried it out.
Henry, I spoke with the Minister of Information, Eugene Nnamdi, and he said that being a government critic does not mean that the government cannot protect freedom of information, freedom of speech, saying that the police are investigating, and he denies anything the government might have anything to do with this.
Well, I expect the minister to do just that. It is the minister's job to protect the government. At the same time, it is the government's responsibility to protect me as a Liberian citizen who is simply exercising his constitutional right of free speech. As I said, I have no facts whatsoever to point accusing fingers to the government definitively, but I cannot think of anyone who would have the motive to attack me other than people loyal to the government or impressionable, misguided elements within the system. But again, I blame the government for inciting this sort of attack. The rhetoric, Mr. Borty, referring to critics of the government as enemies of the state, and the Minister of Finance openly stating that the CDC government will weaponize their radical, fanatical supporters against opposition. And the chairman of the ruling party, Mr. Moba Malu, openly, flagrantly, unsubstantiatedly accusing opposition people of planning to assassinate the president. These things, I believe, Mr. Borty, give rise to this sort of brazen attack against people such as myself, the most critical and vocal voice on the radio in the country. That's where I believe it comes from.
Mr. Costa, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, sir.
That was Liberian political commentator Henry Costa, owner of Roots FM. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of Delaware. Liberian Information Minister Eugene Nnamdi says the government of President George Weah will continue to uphold freedom of speech and freedom of political dissent, as evident by a vibrant political discourse in the country. This comes after a radio station owned by one of the government's critics, was attacked by armed men for a second time in about 2 weeks, and the station's transmitters and other equipment taken. Henry Costa, the owner of Roots FM, says he suspects radical elements within the government or the ruling Congress for Democratic Change to have carried out the armed attack. Information Minister Nnamdi says police are investigating the matter and that those found responsible will be brought to justice.
Being a critic does not preclude the government from protecting its citizens. We have an obligation to protect all of the citizens, the critics, the non-critics, the supporters of the president, those who are in opposition. We have been striving to ensure that we have freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and an environment where political dissent can happen. So when these incidents occur, we as a government have a responsibility to investigate and bring the culprits to justice. We have absolutely no incentive to go about vandalizing the radio station of any individual, whether they are supporting the government or not. In fact, it's a disincentive for us because now who looks bad? You know, it's the government's responsibility to protect all of its citizens. And when these things happen, it is the government who looks bad. So we will not in any way order or sponsor such an illegal activity. Now, I must hasten to say that the Liberian National Police has a record of bringing such cases to closure. You remember when a young Liberian journalist, Mr. Brown, was brutally murdered? At the beginning, most people thought the government had a hand in it, only for us to discover later on, after an investigation by the police, that somebody was arrested who had absolutely no connection with the government, who had motives other than political ones. And he's right now in court facing justice.
Let me get you to respond to this quote here from the Reporters Without Borders, one of the officials. This second attack in less than 2 weeks clearly shows that Roots FM is being subjected to a persistent and unacceptable violation of the freedom to inform, in which a government role cannot be ruled out. Can you respond to that?
Our response is, as I have said earlier, we have absolutely no incentive to attack a radio station that we have just granted a license to knowing fully well that the editorial direction of that station would not be something that we necessarily agree with. But like I said, we have a free press in Liberia. The government will do everything to protect the space. The first time the quote-unquote attack happened, Mr. Costa himself said that his security have allowed it to happen. We are investigating all of this. We will continue to uphold freedom of the press and freedom of speech and freedom of political dissent. And this is what is happening in Liberia. I mean, apart from Mr. Costa's session, I mean, you can see the very vibrant political discourse that go on in our country always. So we are confident that, you know, with the police looking at all of the elements surrounding this issue, there will be a conclusive investigation and those who are responsible will be brought to justice. I can understand from whence our SF comes from. You know, they are a watchdog group for journalists. So when anything happens to our journalists, they usually jump to the conclusion that there must be some political motive. But I can assure you that this government has no reason and has not participated in any such action. In fact, we are doing everything possible to ensure that the space for dissent, the space for criticism, even when we don't agree, most of this because this is a democracy that we have.
Minister Nabwe, we're always happy to have you on Daybreak Africa. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Protesters burned tires and set up roadblocks in Guinea-Bissau's capital last week as students rally against a proposed teacher strike. Carlos De Silva, a civil society activist, tells Ricky Stryak that if the teachers do strike, which they say they will do starting tomorrow, Thursday, the school year will be invalid due to earlier strikes.
Many people, politicians, they try, you know, to get involved, you know, to take advantage of this opportunity, you know. And they try also to use some youth, you know, to infiltrate on the strike and to do some lootings and some and the bad things as it happened last time.
Who would be infiltrating that? Would it be opposition party or would it be ruling party? Who did the students say was doing this?
They didn't mention, but they just say the politician in general, you know, because as it's been said in the rumors that some politician they pay some youth, you know, to go and get infiltrated and to create this problem, you know, that we saw last Friday.
Why are the students protesting?
Yeah, they're protesting because the teachers, they threatened that they will go to another strike soon if the government do not solve the problem.
So the teachers are planning to strike on February 14th?
Yeah, that's it. They want another strike because they allege that the last memorandum of understanding they signed with the government, none of the points has been fulfilled by the government. So they will deposit a new notice of strike, and the strike will start for February 14th for 16 days. And that's what the cause that the students, they went on a strike last time because they were stuck for 4 months. They didn't study. And if they go on another strike, it means that each school will not be validated. Though there were fear. That's why they went on strike, to make pressure on the government, you know, to pay teachers, and the teachers cannot do the strike.
And the teachers are striking because they have still not been provided the training that the government promised they would have.
Yeah, they say first there's some debt with the new integrating teachers, I mean new teachers that have just been finished. And also they're going on strike because there is a status of teachers' careers that have been promulgated by the president, but so far it's not in our official bulletin. And also the memorandum of understanding that they signed with the government, none of the points has been fulfilled. So they mean the government is not serious.
That was Carlos De Silva, a civil society activist in Guinea-Bissau. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Bissau. Burundian women have been speaking about the role they played in peace building during the country's ethnic violence that took place in the 1990s, during which more than 300,000 people were killed. Moses Havia-Rimana revisited the community that was most affected by the violence.
This is Mutakura, located in the outskirts of Bujumbura. Majority of the Hutu ethnic group, which is considered to be more than 80% of the population of the country, lived here. But during the 1994 ethnic violence, most of the men here joined a rebellion to oust the Tutsi-led government. Women became vulnerable as they were left behind with children in the middle of the crisis. Mahera Georgette, also known as the General because of her resilience, says that she helped reuniting the local communities through community work. She says she formed an association of women and started building demolished houses of Hutu living in Chibitoki and houses of the Tutsi who lived in Mutakura. Mahera says, as a woman, she reunited Burundians through social activities and hided several Tutsis from being killed in the Hutu-dominated Mutakura. Although more than 80% of the Burundians are Hutu, the political power used to belong to the minority Tutsi. The social differences and ethnic tensions between the Tutsi and the Hutu peoples led to the political unrest in the country, as Hutus were physically identified by large and short nose, while the Tutsis have long pointed nose. Ndayisenga Mariam is a former rebel turned peace advocate.
Mimi ndo kitu kisababisha mimi naenda mstuni.
She says that she joined a rebel group with her husband in 1993 after the assassination of President Melchior Ndadaye, the first democratically elected Hutu president. Mariam says that after years in the bush, she realized war was not the solution, but rather advocate for peace and uniting Burundians through her association that sensitized victims and casualties of the conflict. A 136-page book of the Burundi's unsung heroes was launched with mostly women who played a critical role in the peace building of the country, telling their stories and the challenges they faced during the bloody ethnic conflict. Ines Ininahazwe is a Burundian citizen and a feminist.
I was amazed, impressed when I read the book. I have heard about unsung heroes. Leaders, women from rural areas, contributed a lot for reconciliation of their communities. And it's most of the women who did not go to school and who lost their relatives. They are resilient women.
Burundi is steadily gaining relative stability after the 2015 political crisis, which was feared to turn into an ethnic crisis. Both Hutus and Tutsis in Burundi live together, and the intermarriages have continued in large numbers, which wasn't the case a few decades ago. Burundi formed a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in order to strengthen a national cohesion and consider the ethnic divisions as history in the country. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Armed men burned down a hospital in the Cameroonian town of Kumba this week, forcing patients and medical staff to flee for their lives. Cameroon's government blames the attack on separatists who are demanding independence for the country's English-speaking region. A Liberian political commentator and critic of President George Weah and his government said he suspects radical elements within the government or the ruling Congress for Democratic Change to have carried out an attack on his radio station. But the Liberian government says that it will continue to uphold freedom of speech and freedom of political dissent, as evident by a vibrant political discourse in the country. That's it for this Wednesday, February 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strike, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, peepsters. Welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Boy, do I have a show for you. 55 minutes of cool, commercial-free, pan-African music. Hear your favorite current Afro beats. Discover new music from Ghana and meet Blinky Bill from Nairobi. He's just released a new album.
Even if you know a lot of things, there's no guarantee that you're gonna see it tomorrow.
Revel in earthy African classics from Mali, Cape Verde, DRC, and South Africa. All this and more this Sunday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Just tune in to your local FM station and meet me there. Music Time in Africa.